Previously on Beta.
Accept our efforts in the spirit of sportsmanship with thy guidance, thy kingdom, power, and glory forevermore. Amen.
In order to restore calm, I'm invoking my authority as airport security to dock you one full ranking point as a punitive measure.
If I have to listen to Glenn Campbell, man, that's like the cowboy Wayne Newton as far as I'm concerned.
Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Doug Gordon, once again asking you to please be safe out there. Coming up today on Beta, Milwaukee native and drummer Joe Wong joins us to talk about his debut solo album, Night Creatures.
I can remember the first time I played drums with another musician and how incredible it felt. And in some ways, I feel like I've been chasing that feeling my whole life.
And author Mary South takes us inside her debut short story collection, You Will Never Be Forgotten. The book explores how technology affects our relationships.
My stories have often been compared to the show Black Mirror. I enjoy some episodes of it more than others, but the episodes that I really do enjoy are the ones where they really are grounded in the characters' emotions.
But first, Drew McGarry. He's a journalist, humor columnist, and novelist. Drew's probably best known for his work at GQ magazine and his hilarious columns for the sports site Deadspin. Drew's most popular Deadspin feature was his annual NFL Teams preview called Why Your Team Sucks. Each year, eager Deadspin readers would await their chance to join Drew in lambasting their favorite team. But last fall, Drew resigned from Deadspin. He joined his colleagues in a much-publicized walkout protesting the new management and direction of the site. Since then, he's continued his work for GQ and put the finishing touches on his latest novel, Point B. However, the book and Drew's entire life was put on hold after a very serious health scare.
I suffered a catastrophic brain hemorrhage in December of 2018 after I had hosted an award show for Deadspin, where I was working at the time. We were in a private room doing karaoke because we were being fancy pants. And then I went out into a hall, and I don't remember what happened after that. I had the blanks filled in after the fact, but I collapsed. And so I had to be rushed to one hospital where they thought I was just drunk. I was not just drunk. And then they did a CAT scan on me and realized that I was in very, very grave danger and got me to a different hospital because I required a certain brain surgery. Anyway, I was in a coma for 2 weeks after that. I was in the hospital for another 3 weeks after that. And I finally got out, which was good because when the accident happened, I was two chapters away from finishing the first draft of Point B. So that was very nice to be able to finish that and not leave it hanging before I shuffled off the mortal coil.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And you mentioned you were having karaoke. Do you recall what song you sang?
I do. I remember intimately. It was You Got Lucky by Tom Petty. Like, I don't know about you, but certain people have karaoke staples
Yes.
that they usually rely on. Like, I'm good with Purple Rain and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
If I had a beer and was feeling frisky, I was like, I'll try something I haven't done before. And then I had some pizza and I had a beer, and then I collapsed. But I did manage to sing the song, so that was nice. Yeah.
How fitting that it was that song that you sang.
Right, yeah, yeah. The joke I made was that it's either fitting or ironic, depending upon how you look at it.
Yeah. Yeah. What was your recovery process like?
Well, one was just doing nothing because the brain just needs time to heal on its own. And then I had to get out of bed, which was its own adventure. So I had to go to physical therapy at the hospital and back home, both inpatient and outpatient, so that I could learn to walk steadily again. Like, my mind was still there when I woke up. Everything, all my memories were there. My identity was still there. But, like, certain things, like, I couldn't stand up for very long without feeling nauseous, because that happens when you have a traumatic brain injury. And otherwise, it was really just this gradual process to get my brain just back to where it could do basic civilization tasks all over again. And, of course, there is no civilization now, so it was all for nothing.
Yeah. So how did this experience change the way you live your life?
I mean, it changed it physically because, like I said, I'm half deaf now.
Yeah.
It affected me in other sensory ways that I'm going to write about down the road. You know, I think if you talk to anybody who's suffered a TBI, and there are millions of us, 1.5 million every year, it can affect your personality. It can affect your mood. In my case, my mood was just a touch worse. It was obvious to my wife and to my kids, but it wasn't clear to me. And so I had to understand that I was somewhat blind to the ways that I had changed and to rely on them to see me through so that I could be a better version of this new self that I am.
Yeah. As you mentioned, you'd written the first draft of Point B before this happened. So how did this episode influence the rest of the writing of Point B when you went back to it to write the next draft?
It actually didn't. Because I had already written about what had happened to me. I'm going to write about more. And, you know, there were some thoughts I had about death that went into the book, but not a tremendous amount because I had had the whole story laid out before I got hurt. And I still believed in the story and I still loved it. And I didn't wake up thinking, well, I have to change everything now because I have this new outlook on life. It was, I can't wait to finish this. I felt as if the coma was this really annoying interruption in the middle of the process that I didn't want to be there. So oddly, I was like, I just wanted to get back to where it was, which sort of also factors in the story of my recovery because I want everything to be exactly the same as it was prior to my injury, Point B included. But I, of course, was not the same. Yeah. And again, I had to accept that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can you tell us a bit about your protagonist in Point B, Anna Huff?
Yes, the brave Anna Huff. Okay, Anna loses her sister to suicide. Well, this is a world where everyone can teleport. And so imagine if the man who's bullying you in cyberspace can actually come teleport right to your house and do so. This is a man who menaced Anna's sister and essentially drove her into death by suicide. And so Anna, grieving and devastated by what the world of teleportation has wrought upon her, seeks shelter at a fabulous elite prep school called Druskin, where students are not allowed to teleport. And in the course of that, she falls in love with her roommate, Lara Kirsch. Lara Kirsch disappears. And so the fact that she's fallen in love with a girl who disappears, and the fact that her sister's killer is still out there somewhere, gives her all the reason she needs to scheme and figure out ways to bust out of Druskin and to port around the world and to chase down both love and revenge in equal measure. And that's my elevator pitch for you.
Yeah, that's a good elevator pitch. You had an actual physicist, Matt Bellis, physicist this book for you, as you so poetically put it. Matt taught you about quantum mechanics. How did Matt's knowledge and what you learned from him, how did that influence your novel?
Well, obviously, you can't teleport. You're not going to be able to teleport. But if you could, if you teleported, when your body disappears, you leave a vacuum. And that vacuum has to be filled. Well, what does it get filled by? Air. And all that air would get sucked into that spot in an instant, and it would make a clap. It would make a noise. It would go poof. At the same time, when you reappeared, you would be displacing air. And that air would need somewhere to go. And so what would happen is you would give off a port wind. The air would shove out from the place where you appeared and blow onto other people. And so those were two really big things that makes it believable. Because what happens with sci-fi is that the reader will give you one thing. If you're like, okay, I can teleport using my phone, all right, fine. But you better believe everything else that happens around it, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that's why I talked to Matt and ended up learning more about atomic displacement than I thought I would.
Mm, yeah. Now would be a great time to have you read an excerpt. And if you could set it up too, that would be great.
Yes, I could do that. Okay. Anna and her best friend at Druskin Academy, Paul Bammert, have figured out a way to teleport off campus. But this is their first night testing the technology under cover of darkness without school officials noticing. So are you ready?
Yes.
All right. It was getting dark enough now to provide Anna and Bammert with a bit of cover, but not so dark and late as to have security roaming around with mag lights. Behind the Druskin Infirmary, there was a decent-sized patch of woods where kids would go to get high and drink hard soda. They called it the Crater. We shouldn't do it right in the spot, Anna said when they arrived. It needs to be offset a little. I concur. They walked another 10 yards west and turned south, following the towering Harkness Wall, stepping over and around felled trees that had been euthanized after emerald ash borers had stuck through the perimeter. Autumn was coming on strong now, every step they took causing the dead leaves to crackle and snap. The wind grew hostile. Anna got dizzy from looking around so much to make sure they were alone and unseen. She needed 8 more sets of eyes to feel secure. Here, she said, stopping next to a thick oak tree. Bamert hung the blanket on one of the branches, and she slipped underneath. The branch broke, and the 15-pound blanket tackled her like an oncoming linebacker. Are you okay? Bamert asked. I'm fine. This is fine. They hung the blanket on a sturdier branch this time. She ducked underneath, opened the map, zoomed in on her location, and chose a pin 2 feet away from where she was currently standing. A fly landed on Anna's shoulder. She laughed out loud before shooing it away. She hit port, took a step, and felt the shiver. Now this was proper porting. No burning, no needles. She had never been so happy to feel so cold. She took her step into the hole, and for a fraction of a fraction of a second, the cold encased her. You didn't pass through space-time, so much as space-time passed through you. It was like a sneeze, a strange reflex that sealed your eyes shut and would probably kill you if it lasted any longer than it did. The great vacuum of air created by your exit from this plane sucked the blanket toward the void and left it stick straight for a millisecond before it flared back out and plummeted to the ground. That heavy covering was enough to keep the port clap from echoing beyond the woods. Anna appeared again right next to the blanket, the gust from her reappearance blowing Bamert's tie over his shoulder. He covered his face to keep from squealing with delight. It works! He whispered. It works. They looked up at the Harkness Wall, its battlements blocking out the coming moonlight. Think we'll get past it? Anna asked him. Sure as sunlight we will.
There's a lot of funny dialogue between the characters, but you also tackle some very serious issues, such as immigration, surveillance capitalism, and hate crimes. How big a challenge was it for you to weave back and forth between the comedy and the dramatic elements?
That part actually wasn't very hard because you and I, we live in this crap every day. So it's like, and especially now, you can't avoid it. There's no avoiding it. It's just smothering all this news and it's omnipresent. And there's no way to build a world that resembles this Earth, but a few years removed from now, that is not very much like the insanity of right now. Because I don't think that insanity is going away anytime soon, no matter what happens with the pandemic. I think it's lasting and I think it's permanent. It's a kind of societal brain damage that I did not expect even when back before my own brain was damaged.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You were one of the founding contributors to the NFL humor website, Kissing Susie Colbert. And then you joined Deadspin, where you unleashed your finely honed McGarry-esque sense of humor on the wide world of sports. Why do you like making fun of sports?
Because sports is so eminently self-serious, it deserves to have its ass kicked every day. Even now, like, there's so much sports news being left on the table right now that I think Deadspin would have covered well, but, you know, leagues experimenting with, you know, figuring out ways to come back and how ESPN, you know, has to essentially lean on 10 hours of Jordan filler documentary to create its own sports news ecosystem.
First of all, there's no backstabbing going on here, okay? Okay? You understand me when I say that? There's no backstabbing going on here.
You know, all the stuff is really interesting, but it's not being covered the way it ought to be covered because, of course, the people who are making all the mistakes are either the places that are in charge of doing the coverage or are beholden to the to the places that are messing up through access and broadcasting rights and all of that stuff. We always agreed that Deadspin was less a site about sports, but really about sports culture. And right now, sports culture is very weird and is responding to this outbreak in very typically sports culturist ways, you know, with equal bits of machismo and ignorance and blind stupidity and pretend compassion, you know, in ways that deserve to be called out.
Mm-hmm. Last year, Deadspin all but dismantled after new management decided to interfere with the site's editorial direction. You were the marquee name who resigned. Can you talk about your take on the situation?
Yeah, I can talk about it. Yeah, sure. I think we all knew things were going poorly with our new owners at Great Hill, that they bought all our sites, but they didn't particularly like them or even know what the point of them was. I don't even know. I really don't know why they bought the sites. But it became increasingly clear that come hell or high water, they were going to make us change the site in ways that we just simply didn't want to do. So in that way, we sort of saw the end coming, but I don't think any of us anticipated it happening over the course of 2 days with all of us quitting in unison. It certainly was not premeditated. But once Barry Pachesky was fired because he, you know, jokingly put a bunch of non-sports stories on the front page of the website, then the guy beneath him, my friend Tom Lay, resigned. And once Tom resigned, it felt as if the spine of the site had just been ripped out, and there just wasn't going to be anything left, because so many times over the years we had just knuckled down and done our work and tried our best to ignore all the BS going on above us. But then there was this very short time frame around Halloween of last year where it became instantly untenable and we all had to quit.
Mm-hmm. It seems like right now during this COVID-19 quarantine with all major sports on hold, that a site that wasn't just sticking to sports, like as Deadspin was, would drive more traffic.
You would think.
Yep. Getting back to the idea of making fun of sports, is there a particular sport that you find is low-hanging fruit that you enjoy making fun of?
Yeah, the NFL. Of course it's the NFL. I mean, the NFL and college football take themselves more seriously than any other sport.
Speaking of the NFL, one of the things you're most known for is your annual NFL preseason column series, Why Your Team Sucks. Can you talk a little bit about this concept and how you came up with it?
Yeah, I remember back in the Wild West days of the internet, like around 1998, because I'm a Vikings fan, and that was the year they went 15-1 and went to the NFC Championship game, and I was on the sporting news forums, and I would troll other teams' message boards by writing a lengthy post about why the Vikings are better than you. I, of course, would pay the ultimate karmic punishment for that. But I just remember that previewing or talking about teams in a way that was completely derogatory was fun, because the average preseason preview of a team is always full of hope. And when every player feels better than they have in years, and, oh, well, this rookie could be an up-and-comer. And so they're always giving you reasons to hope. And those hopes usually get dashed within the first half of week one. And all fans know this. So, you know, the instant that we started the series at Deadspin, people started writing in right away, because there's no team that NFL fans love to hate more than their own.
Drew McGarry, thank you very much.
My pleasure, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Drew McGarry is a journalist, humor columnist, and the author of the novel Point B. Find out more about Drew at wpr.org/beta.
So I want to capture a range of voices, a humorous voice, a comic voice, or a deeply grieving voice, and sometimes even within the same story, because we all have that inside of ourselves.
Mary South joins us to talk about her debut short story collection, You Will Never Be Forgotten. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Mary South is the author of a short story collection called You Will Never Be Forgotten. It's her debut. The stories feature characters trying to use technology to escape their uncontrollable feelings of grief, rage, or despair. Mary uses carefully crafted sentences and a fair share of dark humor to show that the results aren't always what her characters hoped for. Mary joined us from her home in New York City. A brief word of warning, our conversation deals with adult themes, including rape and suicide. Here's Mary reading an excerpt from a story called Frequently Asked Questions About Your Craniotomy.
I feel betrayed by the brain. The brain is more or less the same in everyone. There is the Broca's area, that cul-de-sac of speech in the arcuate vesiculus, and there's the hippocampus, that seahorse of memory, nestled in the temporal lobe. But when you think of the color red, do you picture the insistent primal red of an emergency vehicle, or the deep burgundy of an aged wine? If I asked you to visualize a chair, Would you picture an ornately carved dining chair or a plush recliner? Similarly, I thought my husband was predictable. I knew which entree he would order at restaurants, which jokes would elicit a laugh. Then I found my husband in the garage after his suicide by gunshot to the head, and our relationship no longer made sense. I assumed I had known the locations and boundaries of things, where he tended to take off his shoes, the weekend afternoons he liked to be left alone. The older brother he used to idolize had overdosed. My husband was sad, and after a while I became exasperated with him because I assumed that I understood where the edges of that sadness were. Now I wonder, when I am resecting a brain to prevent seizures, for example, what am I even attempting to fix?
All 10 of your short stories in this collection explore how technology affects our relationships. What is it about this theme that you find so interesting to write about?
One of the things that really interests me about technology is that no matter how much it advances, no matter how instantaneously we can get the news or how much information we now have than ever before, that our baseline, like human emotions and human psyche, hasn't changed. So,
yeah, so the it's kind of what you're going with. What it seems to me what you're doing in your stories, like, yeah, you as you mentioned, technology evolves, and then our relationships with people's relationships with technology evolve too, and people, depending on the technology and the person's experience with it, they may evolve too in different ways. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I grew up with technology as a millennial woman, still like with a dial-up modem, and just seeing it change over time, so that it's gone from these slow speeds where you're like getting an image downloaded into your computer, like just like a bit at a time, to now like we're getting these updates about the news like instantaneously and commentary about it instantaneously. I'm interested like how that sort of reroutes our psychology, but then we're still like our emotions and our needs are still baseline the same. We still crave acceptance and nurturing and connection with others. So, but now that we have these like amazing tools at our disposal, how do we go about getting them? When we have like an app, a dating app, where you can meet hundreds of people that you would never have been able to meet before in your life, how do you go and adjust your behavior, go about getting that and fulfilling that need? Because the baseline need for connection and touch and all of that is the same. I'm interested to see like how those like core yearnings like then get expressed through technology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You've said that you don't want your stories to become all premise. You really want them to be complex and nuanced, which is hard to do when it comes to the internet. So how do you go about doing that?
Again, it's like trying to ground the story and the characters' emotions, trying to ground it in where they're coming from, to really imagine them fully in my mind and how they would respond to situations in their life. My stories have often been compared to the show Black Mirror, and that's a show I really I do enjoy. I enjoy some episodes of it more than others, but the episodes that I really do enjoy are the ones where they really are grounded in the characters' emotions. So it doesn't just become like a story about like, oh, this is how we have no more privacy anymore, or this is how social media makes us lose empathy for each other. It's really about like, here's a character struggling with like a core trauma or a core desire that they've never been able to fulfill in their life. And like, now how are they going to go about getting that when they have all of these tools? It's really goes back to the character and their emotions. For example, in my book, I have a story called Not Setsuko, and it's about a mother who has lost her daughter tragically, so she clones her and then tries to remake her memories so she can live in the illusion that she has the same child back. The story is not really about cloning, although that's like a futuristic, near futuristic technology, human cloning. I could have made the choice to like go further into that and explore that world and, you know, how people clone children or clone relatives or lost loved ones. But really, I wanted to stay grounded with the mother and her desire to have her child back. I really wanted the story to be about grief.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's talk about the title story, You Will Never Be Forgotten. What can you tell us about this one?
So this story is one of the most tech-focused stories in the book. It's about a woman who is working for, she never calls it out by name, but she calls it the world's most popular search engine throughout the story, but it's essentially Google. She's working as a content moderator, screening traumatic and violent content from, so it's the public, general public will hopefully not see it. At the same time, she is also monitoring her rapist as he is living his life online, seeing like what he's posting on social media. And she starts also monitoring him in real life, like following him around the neighborhood after he goes home from work and that kind of thing. And it's mostly because she's trying to process the trauma of her sexual assault, but also like she's worried that what happened to her is going to happen to other women. So there's a lot emotionally for her to deal with.
Yeah. Could you read an excerpt for us and set it up, please?
This excerpt is more in the middle of the story. The woman has made a fake profile on the dating site where she originally met the rapist, and she has been corresponding with him. But then the whole thing seems really false and wrong. So she confesses, like, this is me. This is the woman you sexually assaulted. Do you remember me? And then, of course, he doesn't ever respond. So this is what happens after that. Anxious since hitting send, the woman stares at her messages, waiting for something to happen, while she tries to determine what she hoped to accomplish with this fake profile and correspondence scheme. Did she want the rapist to acknowledge that he is a rapist? An apology? Professions of love? For him to kill himself? What she gets is nothing. The rapist ghosts. Her need for a reply, even if only a nasty one, becomes more and not less urgent. She follows the rapist online and in real life with greater persistence. She rereads each digital clue left by the rapist and then rereads the rereads. She watches him take lunches, do drinks, socialize. She watches him train for his next charity triathlon, buy bright new curtains, over which she wishes she could but can't make a curtains matching the drapes quip, walk his dog, recycle, be a well-adjusted individual and valuable member of the community. Confrontation is her fantasy of knocking on the rapist's door, and when he opens it, bluntly informing him, "Hi, you raped me."
Thank you. That was great. The protagonist in this story is dealing with a lot of trauma, the trauma of being raped and the traumatic images that she has to watch in her job as a content moderator. So it makes me wonder, was this a difficult story for you to write?
It was difficult. All of that is really sensitive material, and I didn't want to re-traumatize the reader by the way I dealt with it. But then again, I also thought it was important, if I was going to write about these things, that I like fully look at them and not shy away from writing about them, like how fully difficult they can be. What I ended up doing with the content moderation is like I didn't want to go into detail about like the specifics of these videos and how horrible they are. I just tried to describe it when I was introducing the fact that this is the woman's job, just sort of very straightforwardly as I could. And then with her sexual assault, of course, like, I don't want to glamorize that or, you know, sensationalize that. What I hope I accomplished was by grounding it in her emotions and her point of view and her struggle to get over it. I hope that the reader can really feel her pain. It's really about her pain and recovery. I wanted to fully inhabit her and fully present her to the world and do her justice and like have her be seen in the way that she feels very invisible. Her rapist hasn't been held accountable, so I wanted that character to be fully seen and sort of have her justice in a fictional way.
Yeah, and I think you accomplished that very well. You take on fandom in a story called To Save the Universe, We Must Also Save Ourselves. Can you tell us a bit about this story?
Yeah, so this is written in the collective third person, we, a voice of the internet. And I've been watching online, I'm on social media, on Twitter and Instagram, and I've just seen how certain fandoms can like sort of tear apart the thing that they love. They can tear apart actresses or television shows or comics or anything like that. Sort of destroy the thing that gives them the most pleasure. And I think the internet is a huge vehicle for that. It just made me really upset to see it happen and to see, I think we forget when we're on the internet that actresses and people who make these shows are real people. You know, it's easy to forget that there's not just not these products that appear to us, that appear in our Netflix, things that we have to consume. And so I really wanted to like show that this woman, this particular actress who's the star of this sci-fi show, is like a real person who is like dealing with like this toxic fandom constantly judging her and constantly putting her in a position where she has to defend herself, and has caused extreme like emotional stress for her. So I hope that I showed that, but also had some like humor and levity in how I dealt with the internet, because the internet can also be sometimes very funny.
Mm-hmm. As your work, your stories are often very funny. There's a lot of dark humor in them, and that's another, you know, another layer, another level on which to appreciate them. As you mentioned, you've written this story from the point of view of we, which makes it so much more powerful. I can't imagine it being written in any other point of view, because by using we, you're emphasizing the mob mentality that fandom is often subject to. So I'm curious about how you go about choosing point of view for that you're going to use for each particular story that you write.
Yeah, it's a really sort of intuitive process. The we is like looking at the internet, like trying to get that sort of mob mentality that grows, and thinking like, okay, well, what point of view could possibly accomplish this? And so like, okay, then you use a collective third person we for the title story. It's also third person, but it's really, really close. And I ended up settling on that particular point of view because I wanted to show the woman's dissociation. She doesn't even have a name. And I had some early readers say, like, well, why don't you put it in first person? And why don't you give her a name? You know, it's really her story. We're in her point of view kind of anyway. I thought about it for a long time because, you know, I really do want her to be seen in the story. But for me, it's like what she's going through is a dissociation from her trauma. And so even though she wants the rapist to be held accountable, she also feels protective of herself and the need to hide a little bit. So it's about invisibility and visibility. So having it in a third person voice with no name for her or the man who sexually assaulted her, I thought accomplished that. You know, other times I do enjoy writing in just first-person stories, though, and fully inhabiting the characters, the I voice of, like, you know, saying how they really feel outright.
Mm-hmm. Mary South, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Mary South is the author of the short story collection You Will Never Be Forgotten. Find out more about Mary at wpr.org/beta.
Ultimately, what I had to do is treat myself like a client, treat my own project with the same level of seriousness that I would give to Natasha or Penn or Aziz's projects.
Film and TV composer Joel Wong joins us to talk about his debut solo album. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi. I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. I want to play something for you. That was Milwaukee native Joe Wong from his debut album, Night Creatures. Joe is an acclaimed drummer and composer. He's composed music for some of the most groundbreaking television shows of the streaming era, including Russian Doll, Master of None, and Midnight Gospel. Joe is also the creator and host of the popular podcast, The Trap Set. The podcast features interviews and stories with fellow drummers and drumming enthusiasts, including Phil Collins, Sheila E., and Fred Armisen. Joe joined us from his Los Angeles studio to talk about his debut album, his podcast, and composing work, and how his passion for drums kicked off his journey from Cream City to Tinseltown.
I discovered drums as something that I could participate in when I was 11. Obviously, I was aware of drums before then. And I had played other instruments starting when I was 6. But I started playing drums when I was 11. And the drums felt like a vehicle into the world and also the medium through which I found myself at the time.
Wow.
I can remember the first time I played drums with another musician, and how incredible it felt. And in some ways, I feel like I've been chasing that feeling my whole life.
Interesting. That's very cool. You attended the prestigious Berklee College of Music. What was that experience like?
It was interesting. I had already had some experience recording and touring and had found an artistic voice to a certain extent before I went to the school. But then when I went to the school, it made me question everything and subvert my own voice and absorb information from a lot of different sources. And it was a bit overwhelming. I only went for a couple years. And after that, I felt like I had gotten what I needed out of the school. And so then I kind of retreated to a farmhouse in Wisconsin to try to parse through everything and metabolize the information that I had gotten.
Can you take me through that experience and then how that experience combined with the Berklee experience shaped your creative path going forward?
Well, I was at the cabin for only, you know, less than a year. So I was there on a non-functioning farm playing music 12 to 15 hours a day and kind of going nuts. But I was basically trying to figure out what information that I had been exposed to in the past couple of years that I wanted to hold on to and develop and what I wanted to let go of. It was just a way of kind of trying to find my center again.
You started your drumming podcast, The Trap Set, about 5 years ago. What motivated you to do this?
I was on tour with an artist called Marnie Stern at the time. And Marnie is now the guitar player in the 8G band on the Seth Meyers show.
Oh, yeah.
But
okay.
Before that, she made several really incredible experimental albums. And I went on some of her final tours when she was doing that. And we got invited to a taping of Saturday Night Live after one of our shows in New York. And it turns out that my friend Brendan Canty, who ultimately became the first guest on the podcast, was there. And Brendan was the drummer of Fugazi, but after that, he started a career as a film and TV composer, and he had a family, and he had essentially created a well-rounded life and had done everything that I could ever dream of doing. And so after the taping, we drank whiskey together, and I was just basically parsing through all of my neuroses with Brendan and trying to figure out how he built the life that he had.
I have a lot of work to do. That's really it. This spring, I have to finish two films and I have to have a big soundtrack job. And I just really can't, you know, I just have to be working all the time. And it's like when you start drinking at night, you know, you end up spending a lot of time thinking about going out and hanging out with your friends. And it's really great and it's really fun, but you really don't get half the work done you should be.
Right.
So I hate to lay it on you, but
I thought I was feeding the muse the whole time.
I know, right? So did I.
That's how it all started. Basically, out of my desire to work through my demons with my musical heroes.
Around the same time you were launching The Trap Set, you were tapped to do original music work for Aziz Ansari's Netflix series, Master of None. How did that happen?
I had toured years before that with a band called Parts and Labor, which was based in New York. And on one of our first trips out to Los Angeles, I met a woman named Carrie Kirchheimer Druten, who was one of the music supervisors on Master of None and previously had music supervised several shows on NBC, like Parks and Recreation, for example. And Carrie is also a drummer and played in a band in LA called Bipolar Bear. And we just became friends over the years. And when Aziz was looking for somebody to do music for his show, she helped, you know, conduct a search. And obviously, because we were friends, she reached out to me. And at the time, I was working with a partner who still lives in Milwaukee, Didier LaPlay. And so we made some demos, and Aziz and the other music supervisor, Zach Cowie, were really into what we were doing, and that's how that happened.
You've also done the score for Natasha Lyonne's acclaimed Netflix series Russian Doll and Pendleton Ward's new show The Midnight Gospel. You've also done composing work for David Chang's Ugly Delicious and Awkwafina is Nora from Queens. This is a really diverse list. How do you approach scoring for each of these very different shows?
Well, the underlying goal, no matter who I'm working with, is to try to see the world of that show or film through the eyes of whoever is creating it, so I have an understanding of what the emotional needs are from their perspective. And then I try not to think about it too much. You know, early on in the process, we use our conscious minds to kind of come up with a sonic palette for that show so that there's a cohesion between the different cues. And we work on finding certain melodic themes that can carry the film or show. But then after that, I try my best to get into the flow where I'm not thinking. And so everything in my studio is set up so that I don't have to think. Everything is wired into place and ready to go so that I can just disengage my rational mind and let my creative mind do the work. It's almost like if you're eating a meal, you think about the meal as it's going into your mouth, but most of the digestive process is involuntary and something that you're not aware of unless something's going wrong. And I try to be careful about how I'm feeding the ideas into my brain as we're starting the project. But then after that, I just try to let my subconscious do the work.
Well, it's worked very well for you. And during all the scoring work you've been doing, you still managed to find time to put together your debut album, Night Creatures. How long has this project been percolating?
I think it started percolating shortly before I scored Russian Doll.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really, really interesting to watch Natasha as she was making Russian Doll, because it was basically her first project as a creator. She had acted in lots of different things before then, but this was her first kind of large-scale project as, you know, the showrunner and co-creator. And I got to see her confront all of the attendant insecurities that come along with making something for the first time. And seeing her navigate through that was really instructive as far as how I pushed myself through it. But I also was smart enough to enlist Mary Timoney to produce the album, and so then I could be accountable to her. And she's an amazing artist who's done dozens of records with different bands and had lots of experience. And I had played drums in her band, so we already had a great relationship and a similar aesthetic. And so working with her helped me, you know, take my own project more seriously. And ultimately, what I had to do is treat myself like a client, like, you know, treat my own project with the same level of seriousness that I would give to Natasha or Penn or Aziz's projects.
Mm-hmm. And the album feels very personal. You've said it's about loss. How so?
Well, it was written during the time that my dad was dying, and I was parsing through all of the grief that comes along with losing somebody piece by piece. My dad had a massive stroke in 2010, and I had to step in and help manage his life for a few years after the stroke, and ultimately he never recovered. And so I saw him lose pieces of his personality over time, and that's basically what the album is about. It's my way of working through that.
Mm, yeah. I'm sorry about the loss of your father. Did making the album help you come to terms with this loss?
It's interesting because I don't know if you've seen Midnight Gospel, but that theme runs through the show. And then the final episode of the show, without giving too much away, is about confronting the mortality of self and of a parent. And so it was kind of a perfect project for me at the time. Like Duncan, who co-created the show with Penn, was going through that when the conversation that structures the final episode was taking place. So it was almost like one of those situations where it really felt like it was meant to be.
Yeah, and the first single is called Dreams Wash Away, and it can be heard in the season finale of the Midnight Gospel. Can you tell me a bit about this song?
Well, it's a song about coming to terms with the fact that we're all going to shed everything that we think about as far as our personality. So there's a line that says, the weight of wills slowly diminishes and fears subside. All things dissolve in time. And if we look at it from an evolutionary standpoint, you know, all of these things evolved to keep us alive as beings, but there can arise certain situations where our survival instinct is in conflict with our best interests as a soul.
You recorded some of the album in the famous Jim Henson Studios in Hollywood, the same studio where Quincy Jones recorded We Are the World, right?
That's right. Yes, yeah, Studio A. And when Quincy was working there, it was A&M Studios. And prior to that, it was Charlie Chaplin's lot.
What was that like to record there?
It was great. It was a lot of work went into prepping the orchestral arrangements, which is the part that we recorded in at Henson. The level of musicianship from the orchestral players was astronomical, and it allowed us to track the entire album in a matter of hours. But one thing that was really interesting that happened while I was tracking it is I was kind of engineering it myself, and I was talking to the players about something, and I felt somebody behind me, and I turned around and Cat Stevens was standing there. And I grew up listening to Cat Stevens, and so it was really bizarre and kind of surreal, but he said nice tunes, and that was enough praise to get me through the rest of the day. Bathing in the afterglow, dreaming of affections in the snow, long ago. In the shadow.
You met comedian Fred Armisen for an episode of The Trap Set, and you've continued to collaborate with him. If you don't mind my asking, and if you can talk about it, is there anything that you guys are currently cooking up?
I actually met Fred because he's a drummer. And right. When I was a teenager living in Milwaukee, I had a band that would go down to Chicago and play shows. And Fred, at the time, was in a band called Trenchmouth. So I originally met him back in the mid-90s, although he doesn't remember that. But yeah, I helped produce his stand-up special, Stand Up for Drummers. And then as a result of that, I've been kind of mentored by Fred's producing partner, Alice Mathias. And Alice and I are working on developing some other projects for Fred to be a part of.
Oh, cool.
Fred's company.
All right, cool. We'll look forward to those. So what is next for you? Another album, scoring more shows, or perhaps scoring feature films?
Yeah, as far as what's next, yeah, I mean, I feel like I kind of just scratched the surface of what I want to do artistically with this first album. And at the same time, I've developed this muscle of writing a lot of material from my career as a film and TV composer. So I'm trying to deploy that muscle in service of making another album right now. And ultimately, what I would love to do is spend about half my time making my own records and touring, and half of my time either producing shows for people like Fred or scoring shows for people like Penn Ward.
Yeah, that sounds like the best of both worlds. Joe Wong, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Joe Wong is a film and TV composer. His debut solo album is called Night Creatures. Find out more at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Drew McGarry, Mary South, and Joe Wong. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta Podcast via Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions. Special thanks to producer Brad Kohlberg.
He loves food, he loves travel, he's devilishly handsome, and he knows how to do a classic wave and kiss.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
You know, after work, I'm going to go home, cuddle up with my loving wife, and watch 3 to 5 hours of a critically acclaimed drama, and then go to sleep.
Our executive producer, nay showrunner, is Adam Friedrich.
I am sorry for yelling. I'm having a very hard, never-ending night.
And thanks to you, our alphas. We'll see you next week. Take care and please stay safe. I'm Doug Gordon.
Hey, you mind if I interview you for my video Spacecast?